南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Hello everyone, thank you for being here. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. It's great to have you. It's great to know you're practicing. That's the first thing I want to thank you for, maintaining your practice. If you're new here, then this is what we do here. This is our sangha. I will read sutras, read Nichiren's writings, read the Lotus Sutra. There's in the excess of 800 videos on this channel, and there's playlists that are specific to certain sutra, like the Lotus Lectures, where I literally read every single chapter of the Threefold Lotus and interject constantly with personal insights, translation muck, right? The biases of the authors, the translators, the academics, who bring their cultural biases into, I mean, they're professionals and they're trying to transliterate from other languages and other sources into English or French or whatever your translations are that you're reading from. But you have to realize that they come from a cultural reality. So they're going to read certain concepts and go, well, how do I say that in French? How do I say that in English? And they're going to use words that they can't help it. They're key words for them. And a lot of that comes from the religious overtones of their cultures, right? If they're Italian, if they're French, if they're French Canadian like me, if they're American, even though the vast majority of Americans aren't religious in the sense that they go to church all the time. I'm in the South. You know, if you don't congregate at a certain church, then it affects who you do business with, how you spend. I mean, it's still very pervasive, this idea of Christianity in North America. But there's every color of Christianity you could possibly come up with that suits the lifestyles that those people want to have. They don't want to admit that. They all want to claim that they're the one. But this is the problem of cultural bias. So what I'm saying is there are words that come with that, like faith or prayer. But people, because it's a cultural bias, they don't really delve into the depth of meaning behind those words. And they certainly don't want to admit that they're constructed abstractions of unreal things. Yes, I know as Buddhists, we know that's true of everything. But there's the problem. If we want to talk about strictly Buddhism and how it works and what it is saying, we have to look at the words we're using, knowing full well that the words ultimately we need to eschew, right? Spit them out, get them out of the way, because that's not the answer. But if we use confusing words, then we start to mystify and magicalize our thinking because of the pollution of these cultural biases. So the whole, I say all of this because my motivation for creating the website, for creating this YouTube presence, for creating all of the study materials that I've put together in wanting to, and it's in Gongyo, correctly transmit Shakyamuni's teachings and his ultimate teaching of the Lotus Sutra with the elucidation of our contemporary master, our mentor, Nitrin. And the lineage all the way back to Shakyamuni, right? All the other bodhisattvas who've taken on this endeavor repeatedly throughout history to get things back to the center. In China, there were a lot of cultural biases getting in the way of the clarity of Shakyamuni's teachings. They had to do it. In Japan, in Korea, in India. This happens throughout history. Why? Because man, and I mean women as well, but mankind, if you will, is an ego-based creature. Everything is about ourselves. And ultimately, if we really look at it, ourselves are the body. And I've talked about this before. The body in Buddhism isn't denied. It's just that the idea of body is expanded to include the entire universe. The universe is our body. It is the manifest, or what's the other word, accommodative body of Buddha. Now, just having said that, our idea of Buddha changes, doesn't it? It's not a man. It's not a guy named Shakyamuni in history. Buddha is an experience, an ongoing moment-to-moment experience. It's not a thing. It's an idea. It's a mental shift. An understanding, an insight. Words fail. And that's why it's also more important to use as many correct words as we can, because all those words that we read in sutras and everything else, letters and so forth, they're just fingers pointing. What we're trying to get at is, what the hell are we pointing at? What is Buddha? So that's the reason for this channel. That's the reason we all get together. That's the thing that I endeavor at my best, with over 40 years of trying to do this, understand for myself. Little things in my lifetime of study of various psychologies, philosophies, sciences, self-help, religions, and all of that study has worked to make me a naturally curious and critical person, more aware of my own insights and foibles. And that's what I do here. I share my insights of these teachings with the sole goal of improving our confidence, our knowledge, our surety that this teaching of Shakyamuni is clear to us, and that we know it works. All we have to do is try it, and we know something's happening. But to understand it is to have more confidence in it and to deepen our convictions, right? Sorry, get settled here. So, this next chapter is on offering the law. And I just want to say a couple more words personal to me. Many of you may know, and you may not know, that I have been a fine artist painter for decades. I've done many things in life, and I don't want to review my whole life. We all have varied experiences in life as we grow and so on. But one of my consuming endeavors was the visual arts. And I'm a figurative painter. And getting back to what I was saying about the body, my paintings have always been psychological in nature. That doesn't mean that everyone who sees my work thinks of it as psychological, but I would argue that the very instant you sense my imagery, it is psychology. I have no idea what's going on in the viewer's mind, but I try to signal certain direct or abstract ideas And my thing has always been that either I'm going to present an idea in an unusual fashion to trigger that what the hell is going on reaction, or I'm going to combine images in a way that's going to make it difficult to resolve what is the narrative here, what is going on, what am I supposed to think. And that's what we generally do. We're identifiers, right? So my Buddhist thinking is deeply in my psychology. And when I express imagery for the viewer, for myself as the primary viewer, the first viewer, is to search in this miasm of identification what I'm identifying with, what I'm confounded with identifying, and what may be a trace, like a treasure map. I shouldn't say treasure, but just like almost a scientific psychological survey of where did that come from? Where is that going? Why is that there? There's that why question that always annoys me. How did this come about? And the what does it mean portion? I'm actually comfortable with that question. I don't need it resolved. I just need it to be asked. And when a painting or an image that I create continues to ask that, I'm satisfied. When it seems to have a pum-pump, you know, I call them one-liners. When I look at an image that goes, oh, that's that. Well, now the conversation's over. The idea is over. It's dead. I don't like paintings like that. I don't like images like that. Too easily resolved, which actually is code for, I don't have to think about this any further. Well, if you're not thinking, then you're not living. So, okay. And so I haven't painted for a couple of years now. I've been more and more withdrawing in this last decade, I'd say, into my practice and my desires, my motivations for material have just been slowly dissolving to the point where I can't feel motivated to participate in the thingness of life. Does that make sense? I'm not trying to qualify myself as a this or a that either. It's just something I recognize. I don't do many things, not because I can't physically do them. You know, that's modifying as I get older, of course. I just can't get, I should paint again, and I'll stand and I'll be amongst my canvases and my paints and so forth, and my storehouse of imageries, and I can hardly lift a brush. I've gessoed over some old images in preparation for creating a new image on an old canvas. I know some of you are going, you're painting over your paintings. I do it all the time. Artists have for centuries. To me, none of it's precious. It's a process. Right? I'm playing with the body, which is just a moment-to-moment instantiation. And I want to make something anew, a new thought. And I can't get motivated. I'd rather read a sutra. So, good, bad, or others, I'm not trying to qualify myself. I'm just telling you my story. And last several months, I've been thinking, how would I approach a new canvas? Because what I think I would like to capture is something I've been talking about in a lot of videos recently and for a long time, this idea of energy formation becoming form. And so in a way, because I'm a figurative artist or representational loosely artist, I'm dealing with the phenomenal world, yeah, stuff. But yet my realization is deeper and deeper with every day of my practice that stuff is just this moment-to-moment formation, instantiations of formations of potential energy. How can I convey that in a static visual imagery? How can I grapple with that? How can I indicate that? How can I make that difficult shift that I'm constantly talking about, this mental shift? How can I exist as Bodhisattva, making the painting, at the same time indicating Buddha-ness, that shift, that things aren't things, that things are just a flow of energy, like us, constantly manifesting with this engine of life, this constantly in flux formations energy of you, me, chair, painting. How do I indicate that visually? You might say Nichiren figured that one out first with the mandala. That's a long discussion, and it would be lovely to have you all here and have that round table and just talk about that all day. Yeah. All right. So enough blah, blah, blah. I'm going to get to the Vimalakirti here, but I may return. I'm trying to return to painting just as another communicative tool. And I may fail miserably, I don't know. But that's part of experiencing and understanding our experience as Bodhisattvas. So I thought I would share that with you because I think that all those very same struggles are relevant for you. Maybe you're a salesperson. Maybe you're a computer programmer. Maybe you're a communicator, a teacher, whatever you do in your daily life. And now we get to the point of this sutra, these videos, our practice. We struggle constantly with, there's the practice, my Buddhist practice, and then there's daily life. And we struggle with marrying the two. But what I'm trying to do is saying, that's not where the struggle should be. The struggle should be not in marrying the two, because there we have duality, quite obviously. The struggle should be, how do I live moment to moment in this life, samsara, with my practice, with my Buddha-ness, with my clear perception of the nature of all phenomena? What does that even look like? So you might call that a marriage. I would say it's far more profound than a marriage, which is a unity of two. How do we become a one? And this is what we've been talking about. That's a bodhisattva. Because to be completely in our Buddha, we essentially remove ourselves, liberate ourselves, emancipate ourselves, right? The language of Buddhism, from all manner of duality. Well, ultimately, that would put you in a completely removed state. Well, obviously, we don't want that. We don't want to be a hermit under a rock, which would be a fallacy. Because we wouldn't be living this life, which is our greatest opportunity to manifest, to know this lightniatic moment of Buddha-ness. Without this apparatus, without the three bodies of Buddha, without the accommodative body, the manifest body, How can we experience the reward body of the Dharma body? Only here in samsara can we do that. And the path to doing that, the way to do that, the prescription to doing that, is to be a bodhisattva. So stop trying to be this mythical idea of Buddha as a version of you, and instead understand that Buddha is the mind of a bodhisattva. This world, this land, doesn't change and become another land. This land is where you express and experience Buddha as a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is simply the manifest body of Buddha. And the practice is the reward, and the enlightenment it brings is the Dharma. Right? So this is why I'm vexed by returning to painting. Because it is an opportunity for bodhisattva-ness to instantiate. You could argue, though, that painting is a way of permanentizing a moment, isn't it? If you think of a painting as a static thing, yeah. But I've already described to you, I'm not trying to create a static thing. I'm trying to create a portal of an experience, a question, a what question mark is going on. I'm trying to transmit a searching. So then my painting becomes a finger pointing at something. Can I do it? I think I already have, but the question is, what am I pointing at? So now I want to reinvigorate my motivations to create fingers pointing, but I want them to point at Buddha, Buddha-ness, this manifestation, moment to moment. Right? It's kind of like on Star Trek, where the transporter, the human beings, just turn into a bunch of little light particles. And then, whoop, and then they come back the same way. Little light particles, boom, human being. Believe it or not, that's not a bad visual explanation for what Buddhism talks about. This is happening moment to moment. These little photons of light becoming you and me, chair, computer, wall behind me, mandala. And when you chant to this mandala, you have that sense in varying ways. We all experience it differently, but, and I'm not getting mystical. I'm saying our earthly senses, vision, aural, sensation, taste, so on, they're very superficial transmitters of what's actually happening. They're like a big, sloppy, 6-inch wide brush. They're not into the fine little details that go down to the subatomic scale. You can't see that. But we do experience that. So in the terminologies of a painter, we have broad strokes, we have middling strokes, and we have very precise little strokes. So if we can be informed in our daily life by the information, the Buddha wisdom of those tiny, tiny little strokes in an electron microscope that we can't make a brush for because it's just too huge compared to the minutiae of what's actually happening moment, 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 moment. But if we know it, if we have confidence in it, if we understand that process, it enlightens the way our fumbling senses actually proceed. And without seeing the minutiae, we can see it in our minds. We can perceive the strokes, the broad strokes, for their construction. And that's what we've been talking about in the Vimalakirti, isn't it? Our constructed world. So how do we talk about this to other people? Because it's important. If everyone understood this, even as poorly as we think we might understand it ourselves, or I mean, you may understand it far better than I, but this is our discussion, yeah? How do we bring other people into this discussion? How do we raise their curiosity? Well, we've already talked about that. We simply chant with them. But, you know, not everybody is at that stage of curiosity. Some people need to be comforted as a friendship, and you need to create relationships where you nurture this kind of curiosity. This is going to sort your friendships out quite quickly, actually, because if you remain focused on your practice, there are certain types that will stay away from you. You'll never know them. And other types that are in your environment that you won't, there won't be anything constructive to keep your relationships going. So quite naturally, you will attract like minds, even if they don't know it. And you will push away those that would influence you poorly and take you away from your practice. It may not be obvious, but it will happen. This is that aura of influence of the practice, yes? It does the work for you. So the offering of the law. Let's just get into it, shall we? I'll talk for an hour about this other stuff. At that time, Shakra Devanam, or Indra, spoke up from the great assembly, addressing the Buddha in these words. World-honored one, though I have heard hundreds and thousands of sutras from the Buddha and Manjushri, I have never heard one with such astounding freedom of action, transcendental powers, and unfailing grasp of the true reality. According to my understanding of what the Buddha has just said, if there are living beings who hear this sutra on the law, believe and understand it, accept and uphold it, read and recite it, then they will surely and without doubt acquire the law. Buddhahood, yeah? And how much more so if they practice it as the law directs. If you keep this mind of understanding, of experiencing the actual process of life, how could you avoid enlightenment? Such persons will shut off all evil paths of existence and open the gates to all good ones. What are evil paths of existence? Well, listen to the names, the lower realms, right? Hell, hunger, animality. Right? Those realms of being are hard, difficult, and they certainly don't lead to betterment, love, encompassing compassion. It's all self-obsessed. If you're in hell, you're not thinking about anyone else but yourself, right? But oh, wait. By the time we get to the Lotus Sutra, we understand that Buddha is in that realm as well, because all the realms are in one another. There's a choice being made. 3,000 potential directions to go with tendencies and conditions in every moment. And I've talked about the duration of a moment. And we talked about Mr. Planck and his minimal period of time. A physics and mathematics exercise. But believe me, it's so minute, you can't wrap your head around it. Enough to know, though, that there are so many moments occurring in each moment of thought, we can't possibly be aware of all the little decisions and influences that we are manifesting in our karmic train of tendencies and conditions that then lead us very superficially with our earthbound senses of samsara to make decisions. It's amazing we make decisions at all, to direct our thoughts in a certain way. I mean, this is the game. This is the mechanism that we're investigating as Buddhists. How do I influence so much decision-making toward life-affirming behavior rather than letting myself slip into habit energies that are visceral, self-obsessed, that they don't lead to liberation. They just lead to more attachment, collecting, gaining, losing, right? We're barely conscious, if at all, of that stuff going on. Every now and again, we go, well, how do I keep ending up in this situation? Bingo! In Buddhist terms, you're letting the monkeys run your mind. You need to get your mind ahead of the monkeys. There's a visual, right? Maybe I put a bunch of little monkeys on my paintings. Okay. They will be constantly guarded and kept in mind by the Buddhas, will refute the non-Buddhist teachings, overcome the devil and his animosity, cultivate the practice Bodhi, which is what I was saying earlier, because that's the only way you could live a Buddhist life, is to cultivate a constant manifestation of Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is a human, a sentient mind, I should say, constantly aware of the Buddha process. That's what Shakyamuni was. Truly. And rest secure in the place of practice, following in the way trod by the thus come one. Bingo! I just said it. You want to fully actualize your Buddhist practice? Namo myoho renge kyo. It should be in every footstep you take as a human being. Namo myoho renge kyo. Hi, Namo myoho renge kyo. How are you doing today, Namo myoho renge kyo? Oh, I'm just fine, Namo myoho renge kyo. Everything is this process of life. I'm going to read it again. Cultivate and practice Bodhi and rest secure in the place of practice. Rest secure in the place of practice. Exist in your life, samsara, within the context of your Buddhist practice. Following the way trod by the thus come one, emulating Shakyamuni. In this instance, he didn't say Shakyamuni, he said thus come one, living in Buddha. By the example of Shakyamuni, Buddha. Right? World-honored one, if there are persons who accept and uphold, read and recite this sutra and practice it as the law directs, then I and my followers will offer alms to them and serve them. In other words, the forces of life in the universe will support your practice because you'll be aligned with life itself. You'll be, I've heard it, in rhythm with. Aligned with, you'll be in concert with life rather than subverting it, working around it, trying to stall it, trying to hang on to something that's moving. That's what this rhetoric is about. Indra isn't somebody who is going to come up by your side like some funky little angel and go, "Don't do that," and slap your finger. Rather, it is the force of life itself that will support your life-affirming behavior. Rather than get balled up and cut off by false aggregate attachments. And if there's a place among the villages or towns, the forest, mountain forest, or the broad plain where this sutra exists, then I and my followers will go there to listen to and accept the law, and those who do not yet believe in it, I will lead to belief. And those who already believe, I will be a guardian. That's words around what I've been saying, like an aura, like an influence. You will influence others rather than being influenced by them. And by them, I mean the ignorant, the people who just don't know any better. Those are your subjects. Those are the people who you will influence. The Buddha said, Shakyamuni said, "Excellent, excellent, heavenly Lord, it is just as you have said, and I will assist you in your joyful task. This sutra expounds in comprehensive manner the Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi of the Buddhas of the past, present, and future, which is beyond comprehension." There's that beyond comprehension thing again, right? Because you can't capture it in words. It's an experience of enlightenment, of seeing things as they really are, just masses of energy forming in myriad ways with habit energy, looking like they're permanent but not. Because everything in each moment is modifying. Nothing is static. "Therefore, Heavenly Lord," replace Heavenly Lord with energies of the universe. What was the word I used earlier? Universal forces, right? "If good men and good women accept, uphold, read and recite, and make offerings to this sutra, they are making offering to the Buddhas throughout time, or timelessness, or without beginning." However you want to term that idea of time into moment-to-moment instantiation, see? Past, present, or future, those, again, that's a cultural attachment aberration that ends up in these translations as though they were real things. But we've already done away with that idea in previous chapters. So why is it being used now? It's a fallacy and it could misdirect your understanding. So let me disabuse you of that, yeah? "Heavenly Lord, functions of the universe. Suppose this 1,000-millfold world were as full of the thus come ones as it is of sugarcane, bamboo, reeds, rice, hemp plants, or forest trees. Suppose there were that many enlightened minds, right? If there were good men or good women who, for the space of a kalpa, or less than a kalpa, were to revere and honor, praise and make offerings to them and provide for their well-being. And if after those Buddhas had passed away, these persons built towers adorned with the seven treasures. There's that number again, seven treasures. Now, if you've studied Buddhism for a while, you know that they put specificity to those treasures, jewels and all sorts of things. But they figure prominently in Nichiren's letters as he defines Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, seven characters. That's what we chant. That's what we invoke the law with. The law of what? The law of moment-to-moment instantiations, life itself. To house the relics from each Buddha body, towers so broad that they cover the four continents and so high they reach to the Brahma heavens, their central pole richly decorated, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, the central pole of this mandala. This teaching repeats itself so often that we tend to forget and get lost in the words, and Shakyamuni himself cautioned against that. And if these persons made offerings of all kinds of flowers, incense, necklaces, flags, pennants, and music, all of them most refined and wonderful kind, and did this for the space of a kalpa or less than a kalpa, Heavenly Lord, what is your opinion? What do you think would happen? Would these persons have thereby planted the seeds of many rewards, many merits? Would they have changed the directions of life itself? Would the manifestations of life in the universe be swayed, influenced toward life-affirming manifestations, and less so the life-unaffirming manifestations? Shakra Devanam replied, "Of many blessings indeed, world-honored one, if I were to spend 100,000 million kalpas, I could never finish describing all of their rewards and merits." This is when you hear concepts about world peace, or other words, labels people give to that. It's a goal of propagation, and this is what these paragraphs are talking about. What do you think? If you gain liberation, emancipation, your life is altered forever, right? But just think, if all of the lives that you touch were working toward that same goal, what would the world look like? Can you even imagine it? The Buddha said to the Heavenly Lord, "You should understand that if there are good men and good women who, on hearing this sutra on the emancipation beyond comprehension, believe, understand, accept." Now listen to these adjectives. Believe, in other words, have strong confidence. How do you have confidence? Understand. How do you understand? By study, yeah? Accept. Because the more you study and the more you experience, the more your conviction grows. Then with all that conviction and understanding and commitment, you uphold it, because why wouldn't you? And as you uphold it, you need to keep that engine primed. You read, study, recite, chant, practice, and practice it. In other words, all of the above. Their rewards will be even greater than those of such persons. Why? Because we're Bodhi. In the act is the enlightenment. It's not something you wish for and it comes with a song. It's something you accomplish. And to accomplish it is to put action to it. And as I've said before, action with energy, karma. And this is karma. This is actual karma. Your energy, your freight train of tendencies and conditions is all this energy manifesting moment to moment. And you can influence all of those manifestations toward enlightenment rather than attachment. It's that simple. Because the Bodhi of the Buddhas is all born from this sutra. The marks of Bodhi are beyond limit or measure, and for that reason, their rewards are immeasurable. I love this sutra. The Buddha then said to the Heavenly Lord, a countless asamkhya number of kalpas in the past, there appeared in the world a Buddha named Medicine King. Thus come one worthy of offerings, of right and universal knowledge, there's the universe again, perfect clarity and conduct, well gone. You remember where that word construct comes from, right? To be well gone is to be a living, active mind, unattached. So you're gone in the sense that your identifying habit energy is now no longer identifying and yet extant. That would be a Buddha. That would be some kind of a ghostly apparition of perception. We're bodhisattvas because we maintain this apparatus to support that mind, which is Buddha. This is samsara. There's the duality you're looking for. Bodhi, bodhisattva, human being with a mind that conjures, albeit conjuring through Buddha. Brr. Yeah, so there it is. Well gone, understanding the world, unexcelled, worthy, trainer of people, teacher of heavenly and human beings, Buddha, world-honored one. The phrase following the name of the Buddha constitutes the conventional 10 epithets or honorable titles for a Buddha. His world was called Great Adornment, and his kalpa was called Adornment. This Buddha had a lifespan of 20 small kalpas. His voice hearer monks numbered 36 million Nayutas and his bodhisattva monks 12 million. So this is just the influence of this life-affirming enlightenment throughout the universe, right? Heavenly Lord, I hate those words. What else can we call him? Well, let's just call him Indra. I mean, that's who it is. That's the personage we've given to these universal forces, yeah? It's a leftover from India. So Indra, at that time, there was a wheel-turning sage king named Jeweled Parasol who possessed all the seven treasures again, and ruled over the four continents of the world. This king had 1,000 sons, upright, valiant, capable of overpowering their enemies. At that time, Jeweled Parasol came with his followers to make offerings to the Thus Come One Medicine King, providing him with all he needed for his well-being. Very supportive. He did this for 5 whole kalpas, and when the 5 kalpas were over, he said to his sons, you too. How many sons? 1,000 sons? He was busy. His wife. Man. Obviously, we're talking about great time periods and the evolution of minds. Mankind, if you will. Whatever the apparatus was to emerge this sentient mind, yeah? You too should make offerings to the Buddha with the same deeply searching mind as I have shown. The 1,000 sons, obeying their father's command, proceeded to make offerings to the Thus Come One Medicine King for another 5 full kalpas, providing him with everything needed for his well-being. So this is just an illustration to remind you that when you practice your enlightenment, when you practice daily your Buddha mindset, as you bring it into the samsaric world through your Bodhi life, the very nature of the universe will support you in doing that. Now, at times you'll realize that and you'll feel like you're a golden whatever. But at other times, we'll have some great fears, doubts, and obstacles, and we'll wonder if this whole thing has been us fooling ourselves. But don't be then pulled, in Buddhist language, right, by that devil, Dairakune no Mao, and all of the Sanshoshima, right? Understand that that is the negative karma, the negative energies that you've accumulated over time that are trying to make space for themselves. They're trying to express. But that only happens when something is ready to disappear. And so you have to redouble your conviction, because whatever the nature of those obstacles can be, and they can be quite serious, appearing quite serious, if you redouble your knowledge of Buddhahood and understand moment-to-moment instantiation, then you can poof them out of existence, quite literally, with your mindset. Those great challenges are moments of great leaps of understanding and depth of Buddhahood. So don't shy away from them. Challenge them head on. Right? I'm not saying it like it's easy. I understand. But you must be determined. You must maintain resolve. If you slip, that obstacle will continue to grow and it will seem insurmountable. You control the monkeys. Shut those little buggers up by meeting their challenge. One of the king's son, named Moon Parasol, sat all alone thinking to himself, isn't there some offering that is better than these? Well, it's kind of an honorable thought. Then, through the Buddha's supernatural powers, the mind, a heavenly being appeared in the sky and said, good man, the offering of the law is the finest of all offerings. How do you defeat an obstacle? How do you make the greatest offering, commitment to your practice, to your enlightenment? Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. We know this because we practice the Lotus Sutra. Back in this day of earlier Mahayana teachings, they hadn't quite gotten there yet, but they're talking about it. The son asked, what is the offering of the law? You know. The Indra said, you should go and ask the Thus Come One Medicine King. He will explain to you in detail the offering of the law. And because I've gone on over 50 minutes now, I want you to have time to consider this, even if it's only a day, these teachings. So I'm going to pause here. And we will take up the Medicine King Buddha's answer to this one of a thousand sons trying to emulate his father's good work. As a bodhisattva, what should I do? How can I do? I want the best possible foot forward. What is it? How do I do it? Go ask Medicine King Buddha. After all, it's a Buddha, right? So we have that to look forward to mañana. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for, don't forget to like, subscribe. It helps push the algorithm, right? So we can do our bodhisattva bit. If you can do more, go to Patreon or PayPal me. You see the links in the video to support this endeavor. You know, it is samsara and it has a cost spiritually, but financially. So if you can support in that manner, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, your donations go straight to your Buddhahood. They don't, I'm just a tool. A vessel, just like we all are. I'm doing my best to be Bodhi. And in doing that, I need computers, I need the internet, I need the stuff just to help me communicate, to help you, to encourage you in your practice. And you know what? It encourages me, because that's Bodhi. So we're all benefiting from this channel. Thank you. Thank you for your practice. Thank you for your support. However you choose to do it. Yeah. All our efforts, mine and yours, go toward Bodhi. Manifesting our clarity, our enlightenment. So congratulations and thank you. Take care of yourself. Be kind to yourself. That will affect those around you. Take care of your health. And I'll see you in the next one. Is it a deal? I will see you here. Promise. I look forward to it. I'm curious to see how this book is going to end, this sutra, right? And in the meantime, bye for now.